Have you heard about the new MagnaGrip Pro Nozzle? The MagnaGrip Pro Nozzle is the easiest, most advanced nozzle ever, protecting you from the dangers of diesel exhaust fumes. With its patented flex magnet technology, the Pro Nozzle easily attaches with one hand from a standing position, can snap on from any angle, and fits flush to the apparatus, saving a ton of space. And MagnaGrip is the only exhaust removal system that offers a true 100% seal. For free grant assistance and to learn more, go to MagnaGrip.com.
This fire engineering podcast is made possible by Tenkata Protective Fabrics. The global leader in flame-resistant fabrics, Tenkata Protective Fabrics enables millions of people worldwide to be great at what they do. Generations of industry professionals serving in the fire service, industrial, and military industries rely on Tenkata fabrics for safety, comfort, and confidence. From the harshest working conditions to the welcoming site of home, Tenkata recognizes the people they're protecting are unique individuals whose lives extend beyond work. Supporting a world of evolving needs, Tenkata's innovations lead the way in user-centric design, technology, and sustainability around the globe. To learn more, please visit TenkataFabrics.com. Welcome to the Command Show.
95.
Starring Anthony Castros and Brian Brush.
Hello, everybody. This is Brian Brush. I'm very excited to be kicking off this episode tonight in place of Chief Castros. He's handed the keys over to me once again to co-host, and man, this is a good one. We got dialed up. I want to start off by introducing my co-host for the evening. It's Chris Brennan, retired lieutenant at a Harvey, Illinois Fire Department, but more importantly, possibly one of the most influential mentors in my fire service career, and also the author of the fire engineering text, The Combat Position, Achieving Firefighter Readiness. And if you've not checked out that book, you need to pick it up. It was written well ahead of its time to address the challenges of the fast-moving and more dynamic fire service that we are headed into. And that's kind of what brings us to the show tonight is that type of thinking, that thinking faster and more decisive in the face of a more dynamic environment. So, Chris, welcome to the show. It has been way too long since we've heard your voice on this broadcast, and I'm glad to have you with me tonight.
Thanks for having me join you, Brian. I appreciate it.
Well, I know you're kind of a man a few words about yourself, but your work has certainly influenced a lot of people, and you know, specifically about this topic for me, it's the reason why I brought you on tonight. You were the one who introduced me to the works of Major Vandergriff through his piece Raising the Bar, and that was, man, well over 10 years ago when I was starting to get into my role as a lieutenant. And your book combined with his works just completely shifted my perspective on our profession and certainly my role as a company officer and heading into this kind of more dynamic fire environment, not just in the sense of fire behavior, but also kind of the information flow that we were getting from UL studies and everything. So, I mean, before we bring on Major Vandergriff, is there anything you'd like to add as far as how his work influenced kind of your thoughts and track on the fire service at the time?
Well, you know, I think that, I mean, I read Raising the Bar and had read it. Chet Richards, who was one of Colonel John Boyd's closest sort of companions in all of Boyd's sort of development process and a sounding board, had turned me on to Major Vandergriff's work. And I had read Raising the Bar at the time that I was sort of researching and writing a lot of the combat position and dealing with the, specifically dealing with the topic of like decentralized command and leadership structure within the modern fire company, the modern fire ground environment. So, you know, I think that obviously those ideas are and in the era that obviously we've been in for some time, but that we've come to understand more and more clearly because of the UL studies, the fireground is an incredibly high tempo, high threat environment. And having prepared leaders from, I mean, really from the newest recruit level all the way up through formal leadership at the command level to operate in that high pressure, high tempo environment is critical. And using the lessons learned in the knowledge base of somebody like Major Vandergrift, I think, is incredibly useful.
Absolutely. I mean, his experience, and we will expand on it certainly, but I mean, you just need to look up Donald Vandergrift if this is the first time you're hearing about him. He's an award-winning teacher, writer, lecturer, definitely specializes in this military leadership and education in this dynamic environment, as they refer to as fourth generation warfare. He served 24 years as a Marine. He's the author of 7 books. You know, we spoke about Raising the Bar, but also Adopting Mission Command and Developing Leaders for Superior Command Culture. Over 100 articles dealing with leadership. It's just amazing the depth of this guy's experience and ability to articulate it in a simple format. So also, you know, Teacher of the Year for Army ROTC, so he has that ability to develop and track record of developing the next group of leaders for the military. He's been on the short list for a number of positions, and just a tremendous guest to have on this show tonight. Major Vandergrift, I could not be more excited to bring you on the show. The other day when you mentioned, when we were talking about the goal needs to be for us to create people who are thinking faster and being more decisive. And I think that is crucial in today's world to not only be able to process information and make a decision, but be very confident and competent when we're doing so. So Major Vandergrift, thank you very much for coming on the show tonight. And Chris, you are the subject matter expert. I'll let you lead off once we get a hello from Major Vandergrift.
And Brian, thank you. I'm honored for being on here. You're thanking me, but I'm the one. I love working with firemen and women and police. I had a 2-hour discussion earlier with the International Law Enforcement Training Association. And then I work with all of you, all organizations. The goal is, like you said, is I've been for about 24 years trying to figure out a way to compress the experience and gain the what I call the experience library a lot faster and intense so people are more prepared. And what I've discovered in some that the current industrial age training does not do that. And so we've evolved. Now I'm working for Numerki's research, and we have just done the D.C. police, and we're working out some other things to do after the elections in November because they're under man right now, but they want us back. We did a 7-hour session with them in June, all their new lieutenants and captains of the D.C. police, and they loved it. They want more. So I'll just kick it off there. Again, I appreciate you guys having me on, and I'm honored. Any way I can help you, let me know.
Awesome. Well, Major, I think that what I'd love to start with, and this is a wholly selfish question, so since Brian pitched the ball to me, I'm just going to go ahead and hold on to it. Where within your military career was it that you were first really exposed to Colonel Boyd's work, and how did that kind of jumpstart your process of thinking about sort of compressing that knowledge gap and developing that sort of rapid decision-making, tactical decision-making process? What was the origin story for that?
Well, since I was a young kid, I was a geek, and I studied military leadership and leadership as well as battles, campaigns, and was fascinated by the German Army, particularly the German Army of the Franco-Prussian War era, not the Prussian Army then. And I got introduced to John Boyd's work when I picked up a copy in 1987 of the Maneuver Warfare Handbook by William S. Lynn, who, by the way, is a close friend and is writing version 2 of that book, and he should be out by December, which will include an entire chapter of my work because he's had a great influence as a Boyd and Boyd acolytes. So I picked up that book when I got to Fort Irwin, California in 1987 as a brand new lieutenant or a first lieutenant from Korea. And I began trying to apply what was in the Maneuver Warfare Handbook, and you get introduced to Boyd in there. And since then, I've been trying to figure out a way to teach the OODA loop, not just lecture on it, because everything I reviewed a lot of people, both business and government service and military, talk about the OODA loop, but I've not seen anywhere how to develop people to do it. And so I've been spending about 24 years doing that, and I think I finally broke the code. I've been teaching that recently, how to use the OODA loop in decision-making and to create a culture of what the Germans called Officer's Taktik, or Mission Command, badly translated. And it's just gone from there. And then when I got to Germany, I went to the Gulf War, the first Gulf War, as a tank company commander. And I began also applying it after I was at Fort Irwin. I was the commander of the Off-War Recon at Fort Irwin in 88, 89, and 90. And I was applying everything in the Maneuver Warfare Handbook. They selected me to go to the Amphibious Warfare School at Quantico, U.S. Marine Corps, as the Army rep. And I met Bill Lynn there, and we started a good friendship. He's a family friend now. He's real close to my wife and I. And he's helped me a lot with my German and translating German lesson, Prussian lesson plans from the 1800s that all focus on building strength of character, the ability to make decisions under pressure and to do what's right when no one's looking. And even in the late 1800s, they did better than we do now today on how to develop decision-making and adaptability. And they did it through problem-solving immersion games. So when I teach both virtual and live events, I use a series of problem-solving games. And some of the biggest things students said this last time, for example, was before we knew it, we were done. We went 7 straight hours, and the students were involved with everything. There was no lecturing at them. They were learning on their own how to employ the OODA loop in decision-making, and how the more of these problem-solving games they do, the faster they'll become when they actually have to do it. So that's it, me in a nutshell.
Got
Major
it.
Go ahead,
Bri.
Major Vandergriff, this is kind of a, you know, you just kind of wove into it, giving us your background and your study of it. But then as far as, you talked about that strength and character and developing that confidence is that how, you know, Chris talking about how this came to be, but then your success in developing it, did you seek out that opportunity to mentor the up and coming officers as being the most effective way to institute the change? I mean, I know in that Raising the Bar, there's so much talk about, working with the NCOs and being involved in ROTC and really kind of trying to shore up those people as they step into the career. Was that part of it as well, as far as you wanting to make this impactful and getting with those younger officers and passing this information down?
Yeah, I did an intense review of ROTC training in the late 90s. And I found out that everything the Army talked about, particularly General Schumacher, the Chief of Staff of the Army in the early 2000s, everything the Army said about adaptability, all the things they did ran counter to that, which is in most organizations today. Everyone proclaims they want adaptive people and leaders, but they don't understand what they've got to do. The hard work is establishing that culture. So I decided not to continue on with a career path that would get me promoted, but take a career path that would focus on turning around how we develop leaders, particularly the junior. And they add as a caveat to this that the methodology that we've developed now is pertinent to all levels. That's what's great about it. But at the time in the late 90s and early 2000s, my focus was after years of intense study, and anybody can find the study on the internet, just look up Chet Richards and I together and look up Raising the Bar. I decided to apply what I had learned and studied to development leaders. And I was fortunate because I got to Georgetown ROTC after spending time down at Duke and Chapel Hill doing postgraduate studies. And I got to Georgetown, and I had a chain of command that basically after briefing them allowed me to throw out the entire ROTC curriculum and throw in one that dealt with adaptability and mission command. And even as late as a few months ago, I got a letter hanging behind me from one of my former cadets. He just took command of Special Forces Battalion and wrote me a very nice letter saying how that work he did in ROTC impacted how he does now. We did things like we replaced all the classes with decision-making games, all the field problems. We continued to do land navigation and marksmanship, but we made all the training scenarios, not training, but we made them into free play force-on-force exercises. And then I've applied the same to law enforcement. And in the December of 2018, I did two sessions for the D.C. Fire Department. Now, they could only afford a couple of days, but we got into how they have a really good fire training center there in South D.C. by the Potomac, and they were able to learn how to apply doing realistic training built upon itself from the classroom to the field. So all these methodologies, all the principles of outcomes-based learning, which it's called, apply to any dramatic organization. And it is better to start early, but again, as I just talked about, in June, 22 brand new lieutenants and captains, which are like middle field grades in the Army, and they really enjoy it, and they're like pressing their command to get us back sometime after the elections here in November. So, matter of fact, the former commandant now got promoted, but he was going to have me try to do 2 5-day workshops for the D.C. Academy and change the whole methodology from where they were at in the industrial age to what I call the decision maker or the cognitive age today, because our problems are so more complex that they require people to be prepared earlier than they ever have. So I hope that gave you an answer. I'm sorry I went a little too long.
No, not at all. I think I speak for both Brian and I, and I'm guessing our audience, when we say we want to hear you go on whatever safari you want to go on, because it's bound to lead us to synthesizing some new ideas ourselves. So one of the things that I guess I'm curious in, digging back to our where you were at in kind of studying the Prussian general staff, and really I think anybody who has spent any time with this material knows that that is that's the spine upon which so many of these ideas are built. What have you seen as being the challenge in taking a mindset that grew out of a very small, tightly knit core of leaders who, you know, we can go back to the four German words all we want, but that Einheit born from years and years and years of working together, that unity from working together like that. How do you take – what do you – two questions, and I'll get both of them articulated here. First, do you see that there has been or was during your time in the service a difficulty in getting that sort of mindset adopted with in sort of the larger bureaucratic structure of the U.S. Department of Defense? And secondly, then, building on that, is there a way to leverage the fact that municipal fire departments, municipal public service agencies are, by their very nature, decentralized organizations in respect to there is no overarching national structure setting culture. There is a lot of autonomous space for these agencies to develop culture, inculcate culture. Do you see a method of applying those lessons that, again, date back to the Prussian General Staff in that more modern set of context for the public safety officer?
Oh, yeah, that's an excellent question. The thing that I've been wrestling with for 24 years of my study is figuring out how to evolve this into application today. And the point that Helmuth von Moltke, the elder, the general chief of staff from 1858 to 1888, realized, as did Frederick the Great, that Prussia would not have the resources or the manpower to fight a long extended war, and they were surrounded by everybody that was an enemy. So they wanted to focus on how to end wars quickly and how to win battles quickly. And they discovered through trial and error and through intensive study that the best way to do that was to focus on development of their leaders and the strength of character, the ability to make decisions under pressure, make decisions in the face of adversary, be it the enemy or be it your own chain of command. The Crown Prince told an army major at the Battle of Sedan for making the wrong decision, and he said, "I was just following your orders, sir." And he said, "I did not make you a major to follow out-of-date orders. I made you a major to adapt to the situation." So they were way ahead of the – and as a matter of fact, when the U.S. Army sent people like Phil Sheridan and Emory Upton and so forth, and I've read through all their papers, they did not see – the opposite tactic culture. What they saw was bureaucracy on the civilian side. They admired the Prussians and the Germans, but they just couldn't figure out how they empowered people where they could go on mobilization at the moment the war started and already be ready to win. Whereas the U.S. Army, we had a great discussion on my mission command page on Facebook a few times. If at the start of the war, I would take the Prussian Army of 64, 66, and 1870 over any army in the world because they were ready as soon as they mobilized. They had an incredible system. And at the heart of it was they developed leaders, Moltke developed leaders that through continual problem-solving games and pre-play exercises learned how to make decisions on little information. And even all their coursework and tests were like that. And it's taken us until the 1980s with Bill Lynn and Bruce Goodman and a few others to understand that. But our system's so entrenched that even though there's a merit there to doing it, it would require changing the entire bureaucratic training system. And this applies to all organizations, not just the military, but fire and law enforcement and first responders, in my opinion, are equal to the military in that they actually need a superior culture because they are on call all the time, and the situations they can face, particularly now that as we have more chemical and more weapons of mass destruction ability of terrorists, the law enforcement and firefighters face incredible complex problems. But fortunately, there's a way to develop people quicker to be more adaptive through learning and through proper feedback that's available now, but the bureaucracies don't want to understand it. And the funny thing about the irony is once I trained leaders on how to do this, I had a fire station in D.C. contact me. Their captains were using it. they are doing weekly decision-making games. And when we go through our course, I start off with military games to teach the methodology, and then the students have to end up creating their own games that are centric to what they do every day. And the students never let me down. They come up with some incredible decision games, but what they've got to learn how to do is to take what they've learned and apply it to get better, to evolve. So all this comes out from my study of not only the Prussians, but all periods of warfare, where even the Roman Legion under Marius offers you opportunities to understand adaptability. They created a legion that was empowerment to the centurions, to the cohorts and maniples, in order to beat the Greek phalanx. The Greek phalanx was unmovable, and that would be the American army today. If you faced it, you could not beat it. But the problem was it was very inflexible, and the Romans adapted a system that allowed people to figure out how to get around it and hit it without orders. And so the optics tactic can trace itself back to the Roman legion, of course, because they encouraged their basic leaders to make decisions faster without waiting for orders. That's what it's all about. So when I see fire departments having to go fight and be called to a house fire or any kind of fire or any kind of emergency, what they're told over the net might be different from what reality is, and they've got to get there and adapt very quickly. And the more empowerment that you have, the quicker that the problem can be addressed. It was pretty wild. The two classes of all the chiefs and captains in the D.C. fire department told me was they were being told what to do and how to do it top down, and they were trying to change that. I don't know if they did or not, but their big thing was waiting for the higher-ups to get there and start making the decisions while they set the conditions. And that's exactly the opposite of why you want. I mean, just look at the Uvalde shooting, for example. I went through all the AARs from that, and God bless those children, taught active shooting to several of the police departments. And it was almost the old saying, ride to the sound of the guns. And if you've got at least two policemen or better, same with firefighting, if you've got enough people to start solving the problem, do it. Empower people to do that. And you can do it with these problem-solving games where they get several of them. My cadets used to get 50 during a school year, 50-52 during a school year. And by the time they went to their training, they were so advanced that they all became distinguished honor graduates of these courses. So the results have spoken for themselves. Is that kind of what you were looking for?
I think so, and I think I'd like to ask you to kind of build on that just a little bit. And
sure.
Within the context of, you know, so thinking about the American Fire Service and its, you know, mission of the fire service is to save lives and protect the property of our neighbors. With that in mind, what would your first be if you were looking at this problem of empowering leadership down to, you know, that sort of classic strategic corporal level, right? You want to empower leadership to your most junior level leader possible, your most junior level decision maker. What would be advice that you would give first to those folks who are in, you know, Brian's shoes and higher up on the food chain to begin implementing that process within their agency? But also, what advice would you give to that more junior decision maker, that informal leader, to kind of kickstart that process and, as the saying goes, get the water boiling from the bottom up?
That's a really good question. I get that a lot. How did we kickstart this? Well, when we were starting with the D.C. police, and I'm sure we're going to begin again after November or after early November, the captain or chief convoy and I were talking, how do we do this? Well, the first thing you do is you take the centerpiece, What is your training source? What is your development source? Where do you start everyone? And you kind of go in and train all the cadre on these methodologies, okay? And all the cadre has to go in the methodologies. And while you're doing this, you've got to start putting selective chain of command in there all the way up to the chief, all the way up to your top level. And they have to go through that course too, because a lot of them are open-minded when they see it done right. And then what we did for a number of police forces, including Baltimore City, was, and there's actually a chapter of the after-action review I wrote in the police adaptability handbook that Lieutenant Fred Leland and I wrote in 2014. We lay out how to do this. So you start at the academy. You start at with your cadre, and then the cadre are tasked. So they take, you want people to take ownership of it. So if you called me in, I'm not going to come in there with a 200-page book on how to change stuff, because everyone's subculture is different. What I am going to do is teach people how to think differently and solve problems, the cadre, and the chief of the Baltimore Police Department at the time, I forgot his last name, but he was a big fan. He was a Raising the Bar fan. He had read it and then called me up, or had someone call me up to come meet him. He says, my policemen right now are surrounded by technology because of 9/11. The federal government's given us everything, but they're entrapped by technology. And I want to get them out to make better, empower them to make better decisions, get in the community. And so I said, he said, how do you do that? And I said, what's the backbone of your police force? He said, sergeants. Okay, so let's develop all the sergeants, starting with the academy and the cadre, on how to think better with outcomes-based learning. And then they turn around and design a course, the cadre do, on how to train the rest of the sergeants. And then the top sergeants turn around and design a course for the lieutenants and captains and for the majors, which, you know, control the shifts and the districts and so forth, and go from there. So what happened was amazing. I did two courses for all the sergeant promotables that were selectees, and we handpicked 20 cadre. And then Chief Bilford, that's who it was, Frederick Bilford, great guy, fourth-generation policeman. Had a picture of his granddad's police chief in a fire department down in the harbor in the turn of the 1900s. It was cool. And he wanted to make the police force better, but he knew he had to train them on how to make better decisions and be more empowered. So I went away after doing these two courses in May of 2010 in April, and they brought me back in August of 2010. And the sergeant promotables all briefed me on their four-week course called the Sergeant's Leadership Course. And what the chief was going to do, or commissioner was going to do, was rotate cohorts of 20 sergeants at a time through this four-week course. And everyone, of course, raised Cain about it, except the guys doing it and gals. And they said, the only complaint was, we needed this as soon as we made sergeant. They loved it. So what I do is I come in and I will show the methodology, but it's up to the cadre that we select to develop the plan on how to evolve the culture of a given organization. Because if they don't do it, then no one buys into it. If I do it, then I'm the outsider. It doesn't happen. So what I do is show you the methodology that's backed up by learning science, as well as historical analysis. They see all the data, all the research we've done, and then I develop them and make them masters of it. And then they can turn around and create the conditions, either the courses or the conditions in how people are developed to evolve the culture, because this is not an overnight thing. So, and they did that. They started to do that. The problem is, when Freddie retired from the commissioner in 2012, the new people came in on the old system, and they got rid of me because they didn't want to understand what I was doing, even though a lot of people told them that this was beneficial, and they wanted to cut money out of training, which happens a lot. That's usually why we fell, because they want to return to what they think are the basics, which is firearms training and basic administration things that keep them out of trouble. But like I said, if you can be in a place for a while, like we did at the Army Recon course, where we were there for years, where we trained several cadre on how to do this methodology, they turn around and train the new lieutenants, E6s and E7s, sergeant first classes and staff sergeants, who are going to be the future first sergeants and platoon sergeants. Then you start making that impact, and we did that. As a matter of fact, a senior instructor, Master Sergeant Papanaglio, currently one of my original cadre from 29 when he was at E6, now he's at E8, first sergeant. But he's a senior instructor there down at Fort Benning, and they're trying to get me back down there because Training and Doctrine Command came in and didn't like some of the things they were doing because it wasn't a process. But anyway, my point is that your question really gets to how did we go about making a culture where it becomes a culture of mission command, or as I call it, the optics tactic culture. And that's the route I think works. When the Prussians did it, they went to the schools first at the lowest level, the mid-level, the captains, the cadets, and the soldiers, and they changed the cadre there. And then they also did it in the general staff training course as well. You keep referencing the German general staff, but really the first thing the Germans changed in their culture was how they trained officers or cadets to be officers and captains to make more rapid decisions. Then they started changing the general staff system simultaneously using these methods. So if I was coming into a fire department organization, I would apply those principles. But the number one thing you need is someone that a change agent that has enough power to protect you as you're doing this. Is that what you were looking for there?
I think that answer is great.
Go ahead, Brian.
I think you talked about, you know, the kind of the environment has to be right for change, and a lot of these people are reaching out to bring you in to institute those changes and provide them guidance. And one thing I do want to pass on is like you said, the principles of it. And you know, a paradigm shift is not going to happen quickly in any organization, let alone the fire service in general. But if you are listening to this and you are looking for ways, I mean, put raising the bar in the hands of your officers, your young officers, it'll start to shift their view on things, pass it up the chain of command, bounce it around. It's a very quick read. And then, you know, as you mentioned, adopting mission command, the text, that is all about developing that superior command culture. So, these are cultural changes, but they are possible, you know, if it's been done and created a more adaptive military, which we have witnessed in our careers, it's certainly possible for the fire service. Major Vandergriff, I just kind of want to follow up with some of this talk. You know, obviously leader's intent is a big kind of buzz out there. But I'd like you to kind of expand a little bit on the difference between leader's intent kind of theory versus the mission command approach.
Oh, sure. So mission command is one of the components of mission command is the commander's intent. And the commander's intent is the desired outcome of the leader's two levels above you. Okay, and it's a succinct paragraph, not page. I've seen pages of it written that becomes what's called a scheme maneuver or the how-to. So this, again, we teach people how to write these things where they're succinct. And the purpose is when the smoke clears, this is what I want to see at every given level. And while supporting the higher level without going too much into detail. But the main thing is to allow your subordinates the latitude to figure out how to solve the problem. That's the key. And then where we come in is we have figured out the way to develop people on how to be empowered and how to solve these problems better so they can be trusted. It's all about trust. The key foundation is trust built on constant learning that professionals should do. Learning never ends. And it doesn't need to be a special course or a course that you're detached from your company from or your station or whatever. Like I said, we had a captain in the D.C. police who I still hear from, or no, from the D.C. fire department. Every Friday is tactical decision game, you know, unless they're on a call. And then they move it to another day. But he's in power. He's trained all his people on how to develop a decision. He tasks his people. Every fireman and woman, they have to create, deliver, and facilitate a fire decision game. And he says the amount of experience he's given his people are incredible. And they sit around now and look forward to these things and ask for more of them. That's what happened every time we've implemented this. We implemented this at the Department of Military Instruction at United States Military Academy, West Point. I went up there numerous times. I did the same thing. I went in there, trained the cadre on how to do it. They had a top cover from Colonel Casey Haskins, who was incredible. And they changed the whole DMI from 300-page slide presentations of Field Manual 7-8, which is the infantry platoon, which is what they focused on, to decision-making in the Maneuver Warfare Handbook, and Raising the Bar was one of their main books. But they created the changes that had to take place. So they took ownership of the learning and the change. That's what has to happen. So Casey issued a commander's intent for that to happen, and with some parameters, i.e. guidelines, and the cadre ran with it. And the cadre that couldn't handle it, they got rid of. You're going to have people that love. The reason everyone preaches adaptability all the time, because most people are comfortable with being told how to do things and when to do things. In dramatic, stressful, complex problem environments, that's the last thing we need. So going back to what you stated, you have the mission statement, which is your short-term contract. Mission statement is what you're going to do. And then your commander's intent is your long-term contract. And when I empower you to solve the problem the way you think you should do it, I give you the latitude to change that mission statement because the task may have changed. The Prussians were the first to ever do that globally and to the NCO level by World War I, where the mission may be out of date, but I just expect you to carry out the commander's intent. That was a big, big change culturally. And it's a big change culturally here now because we have a control freak society where the little mistake, little wrong thing can be penalized. And it's sad because you have to teach everything in the context of a bigger problem. A lot of things are just insignificant. So you train people on, I'm going to give you the intent. So in all our problems, they get an intent from the higher-level commanders, and then they get wrapped up in the little details and forgot. Like we did a class this last Friday morning with two Dutch policemen, two Dutch consultants, the dean of the Australian Police Academy, and who else was there? I had six students virtually for 2 hours, and that they did their first problem. They do a problem every 2 hours every Friday, and they were going down the facts and assumptions for the orientation of the OODA loop, which is the most important thing. Observe, orient, decide, act. Orientation is the thing we teach people how to do. And I kind of hinted to them, what was the commander's intent for this mission? And then one of the students said, oh, it's this. Well, so what does that tell you what you should do? Oh, exactly. If I understand his intent, then I have free latitude to do the things I need to do to accomplish that intent. We had another funny session with the D.C. police where they were they were briefing one of their own decision games, and they forgot to talk about the commander's intent. If they had mentioned the commander's intent, they wouldn't have had to do the things they thought they would have wanted to do. And when they brought up the commander's intent in the AAR, they all, like, hit themselves on the head and, like, man, if we had just remembered that commander's intent, then we would have avoided wasting a lot of time. So we teach people in the courses how important that is, whatever you want to call it, commander's intent, ship intent, but it's a leader's intent. And everyone should have one that's relative to their level, but looking two levels up, what those two levels up may think is important. But again, it can't be multiple pages. It has to be a concise paragraph. And people can learn how to think through that and make it where they don't go into the how-to, they go into the why and then the end state. So does that help out?
Absolutely. I think probably, you know, what I got from, you're kind of talking about missions and a little bit more specific to the outcomes we're seeking in obviously a combat versus the fire service, kind of as dynamic as our environment is, there's a lot more about fires that are similar than are different. But as far as that leader's intent and stuff, and we certainly battle it in the fire service, and I'm sure it's the same in the military, as I've read from your information, is the generations leading the instruction, the generations leading the organization can at times be almost two generations behind the current kind of operational environment. And we're really seeing that in the fire service now. The speed at which information is coming at us, the way more and more information and in the fire ground is being kind of demystified through evidence and empirical research and that type of stuff versus the kind of mystique of experience. For you as an older guy, still being very much in tune with the adaptive environment and the fast-paced environment, how did you kind of navigate those generational differences, and how did you bring to your senior leadership the gap there as far as them not being as current as those who are just coming right out of the field?
Well, you're talking about generational, we're really big on that. And I see a lot of times, like on the mission command page, the older guys going, well, this generation can't do this and this. And I constantly disagree. Every leader or every subordinate, the principles of leadership apply. I'm not going to ask you to do something that I would not do. I'm going to be knowledgeable, but I'm also going to be humble. I'm also going to have empathy towards you as long as you put 100% in, as long as you don't lie. But this generation expects the same thing from all of us, okay? And as long as we continue to abide by those principles, we're good to go. I had a group of kids I took to Gettysburg 3-4 weeks ago using the outcomes-based learning method. It was pretty cool. It was a homeschool group. And their father, as a matter of fact, Bill Finnegan, he's a fire captain in Philadelphia. And he's been a big follower of mine like you guys have been. And I do staff tours on our battlefield tours on the side, and that was our field trip. And I use these methods on the kids, and the kids were all like, wow, you're involved in this, and you're not talking down to us. You're explaining why. You're making it fun because I brought a lot of equipment, and then I taught them how to do the cannon drills and how to fight dismounted, all in the context of the battle itself. And they all voted, the family did, when they got back home the next day. So they have to do a field trip every semester to do some kind of military history. And even though there's six girls and one boy, I told I asked the young girls, why do you think this is important? And one of the girls actually answered, a 15-year-old. She said, well, this is the most stressful conditions that a person will be put under. And now we as women are put under them too, and we can learn from this. And even if we don't go in the military, there's no better way to learn than how people dealt with these stressful conditions than studying military history. And I said, the problem with the teaching of, what do you not like about the teaching of history or military history? People focus on dates and people without talking about the why. And we did a lot of the why there. So I have another group that I'm taking out in a few weeks, a lot of young people. And, again, it's just mutual respect. I continually study every day, not to overwhelm people with information, but to be able to answer and shape the learning to where they like to do it. And so that's what you've got to do. And when I do my workshops, the biggest thing I get, other than there was more than people thought, was the fact that I include everyone in the learning, and that they felt like they actually were there. They were part. They took ownership of the learning is what you want to do. So that's what's key. And the way you do that is through mutual respect and empowerment. And then creating a fail-safe environment that as long as they try and don't repeat the same mistake, then it's a learning thing. So that's important too.
Well, awesome. We are starting to get close to that hour. And I really, once again, truly appreciate you coming on. Major, just pass it over to Chris to see if he wants to add anything here or any final questions for you, boss, and then we'll go from there.
I think where I'd like to maybe, you know, tie things together right now, Major, is to say for the young command officer, right? That young training chief, somebody who's maybe just starting to get a little gray around the temples, maybe has recently had some sort of surgery to heal from a shattered ankle and is in the process of trying to find a new way of approaching things in their career. What would you suggest as good starting points for self-education, your books, as well as any other references or resources or just good starting points for people to start digging into this idea?
Oh, that's an excellent question. So people always ask me, what do you study? How do you set up your study thing? I try to build a tree. I'm constantly carrying a pen and a notepad with me, and I try to see the threads, as the Jesuits at Georgetown call it, the threads of knowledge. Everything's interrelated somehow. So I'll be doing something, and I'll say, how would that make me better at being a teacher and a facilitator? Let's look into it. And so when I started working for Numerkies, the marketing lady says, we're going to set up a marketing plan for you, and she laid it out in detail. And I said, now, the way we're going to do this is we're going to lay out principles and then outcomes, and then we'll adapt off that. And they've actually really applied all this stuff. They used a decision game the other night. They're more or less an IT consulting firm that took my entire course, and they applied a decision game to solve a problem. They were all telling me separately about that. So I go constantly I tell everyone, read the Maneuver Warfare Handbook. Get that book and read it, because it's applicable to anybody, regardless if they're in or out of the military. And then, of course, Raising the Bar. And then now I've got you guys. I forgot I was going to bring it up with you. In December, we published a new book, the Professional Outcomes-Based Learning Handbook, 132 pages. Now, I would recommend adapting Mission Command to anyone. It's 330 pages, but it's pricey, and I didn't cut the price. The Naval Institute Press, which is a very good press, it gives me a lot of academic credibility if you get a book published with them. Problem is, their books are expensive. So my best cadet I ever had, who got blown off a Humvee and had a traumatic brain injury, he's out of the military now, but He runs Special Tactics. Him and I co-worked a book in the fall that is, lays out what we just talked about tonight. Better than, actually, it's a better edition than Raising the Bar. And it's more succinct than, but not as detailed as Adapting Mission Command. So you can find that on Amazon, Outcomes-Based Learning, Professional Handbook, and it's on the Kindle there, and then write the Special Tactics for the hardcover. So you can do that, and we give examples. All the things I talk about, we talk about in a more organized manner. But as far as books go, the main thing that I have tried to do is I look at the why. Why was so-and-so a really good commander, or why was so-and-so a bad commander? Because you'll see that continually through most military historians. So I reach back and try to figure out how were they raised, or who mentored them, who made them like this. And then you start finding out answers on how you want to do things or not to do things with younger people. So I don't have a really distinct – a really good reading list is from Bill Lynn, the author of Maneuver Warfare Handbook. He's got a canon list that are really good that apply, again, to any organization, particularly ones that want to do mission command and maneuver warfare. And simply put, William S. Lynn and canon, C-A-N-O-N, in Google, and the list will come up. Funny, when he created this, none of my books were out. But he, again, like I said, he's writing a new maneuver warfare handbook, edition two, and he has an entire chapter about my work in there because it relates to how to do prepare for mission command. So that's all I can recommend. I mean, I practice what I preach about empowering people. Now they can come back to me and say, they do every day. They say, what do you think about this? And I'll give them my opinion. But we all should kind of build our own kind of professional development style right there. Learning never begins. I just wrote a thing on LinkedIn the other day about using war games and learning, and that even if I've done 30 Gettysburg tours, I know the battle like no other. But before I go up, like I went up that Saturday, the day before, I went over my notes, okay, and just sharpened my thing, something I might miss. Again, I did 20% of the talking. The kids taught themselves, and that's how I do. But learning never ends. My dad used to tell me, the moment learning ends, it's time to go see God. So, and I'm very religious, but I don't push that on anyone, so I hope I didn't insult anyone. It's not my purpose. But I always continually somehow try to figure out a way to learn and be a better facilitator. I hope that helps.
It does, absolutely. I mean, I echo a lot of those mentions on studying and reading from those. I would also direct folks to our co-host Chris, his text, The Combat Position: Achieving Firefighter Readiness.
Yep.
Fire engineering books. It's what brings some of these ideas into the fire service context. And while possibly ahead of its time when it was published, it is right on target for the modern environment and the OODA loop. And I'm so excited about getting to have both of you guys on the discussion tonight and together and discussing just kind of the idea of mission command and some decision-making games and the tools that we go about that. So, Major Vandergriff, we've covered some of your text. Why don't you, in the next couple minutes as we're wrapping up, let people know other places that they can get a hold of you, your current website, former text, and anything else.
The best way to get a hold of me is you can contact Nemertes Research. It's Nemertes Research, and Nemertes is www.nemertes.com, or put in Google Adaptive Leader Training, ALT, and then I'll come up, my whole biography there, everything I've done is on there. But you just put me in Google or LinkedIn, and I come up because I do a lot of writing, a lot of books and stuff. And but if you want to have me come do more information about our virtual or live workshops, like I said, are applicable to any organization that wants to think faster and more confidently, then contact Numerkes, and we'll go from there.
Perfect. Thank you, sir. And,
no,
you know,
you've been great. Thank you.
And you certainly followed up with some emails to us on some new text. And I just, your passion is evident for this topic because, I mean, you are still a diligent contributor, trainer, leader in the topic. And it's great to have you on tonight, and hopefully it exposes some more firefighters to it. So thank you very much, sir. I'll be following up with you shortly after this broadcast to find a way to thank you. And Chris, man, thank you so much for joining me tonight and tackling some of the tougher questions for me as a kind of a subject matter expert on this. And for
subject
pointing out that I am
–
Enthusiast. Perfect. That is a better way to put it. But and then also for pointing out that I am a hobbled gray old man in a trading chief position. So that was an excellent shot there at the end. Chris, anything else from you, boss?
No, not at all. I think, again, Major, it's been a real pleasure talking. And I think that folks who are interested in this sort of stuff should absolutely check out the book. There's a lot of value there. I think there's if you open your eyes to the world of mission command, decentralized command, I think a lot of success can flow from that for the fire service. So I hope
I'm
people take
you,
that idea and run with it.
It's fun to create. I created the entire Georgetown ROTC on mission command. It took a lot of work. But it was so much fun going to work and seeing the cadets running everything.
That is the true gift, yes. All right, gentlemen. Well, thank you all for joining us tonight. Thank you who listened in tonight or who may be listening in on a podcast in the future. Enjoy your day. And as the Major said, never stop learning. Thank you all very much.
Thanks for tuning into Fire Engineering Talk Radio.